From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. 2009 U.S. Open men's champion Juan Martín Del Potro hails from a small Argentinian city that just coincidentally boasts a tennis academy, which turns out a disproportionate number of top-ranked tennis players. Ahead on Only a Game, a report from Tandil, Argentina. Also the story of American passion and defiance in the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. Also ahead, town criers converge on a tiny New Hampshire town for a fierce competition.
Oh, yay! Kind hearts, dear, gentle souls, welcome to this splendid soiree! Stay tuned!
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Though Major League Baseball's champion won't be determined until early November, late September is a reasonable time for speculation about matchups in the playoffs. That's what I was doing this week at Fenway Park, where the likely AL Western Division-winning Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim were visiting the apparently wild-card-bound Boston Red Sox of Massachusetts. These two teams faced each other in the postseason in 2004, 2007, and 2008. The Red Sox won 9 of the 10 games played during those series. Lyle Spencer, who has been covering the Angels since spring training for MajorLeagueBaseball.com, says that if the two teams meet again this fall, his guys will just have to forget that particular segment of their history.
The key is to figure out a way to push it in the back of your mind and not let it sort of tie you up. You know, you got to play free in this game, especially this team. This team runs and plays a kind of a wide open game. It'd be kind of like a fast break basketball team that all of a sudden feels like it has to slow down and play half court, and they really can't do that.
Can't think too much.
No, absolutely not. Not in this game. That's a severe detriment.
Lyle Spencer's caution against thinking notwithstanding, I couldn't resist encouraging some of the Angels to think ahead to the possibility that Anaheim would not only get past the Red Sox this time around, but also meet their Southern California rivals, the LA Dodgers, in the World Series.
I think that'd be a huge deal. It's the same kind of series as New York Mets and Yankees and also Cubs White Sox. It's a freeway series, two LA teams battling it out, and I think it'd be quite a series.
That's Angels pitcher Trevor Bell, who may have a better sense of the potential drama of an LA-Anaheim World Series than lots of his teammates, since Bell was born in Southern California. But in the Angels clubhouse Wednesday afternoon, it was obvious that even newcomers to the left coast can see the potential of the matchup.
You're talking about during the season when we play those guys? Oh, it's sick.
That's outfielder Torrey Hunter, who came to Anaheim in 2008 after 11 seasons with the Minnesota Twins.
Last year was my first taste in 2008, man. I saw the red and the blue and people going crazy, the fights in the stands. It was crazy, and I thought that was pretty awesome. And just thinking about he possibly could be a World Series like that, that's pretty impressive. It could have been like that last year. It didn't work out for neither team, but it definitely could be possible this year, too.
Both the Angels and the Dodgers have been playing well enough to entertain postseason dreams for several months, but the potential confrontation of these two accomplished teams also offers attractive subplots, according to Hall of Fame pitcher Dennis Eckersley, now employed as a television analyst by the Red Sox.
I think the Angels have always been dumped on because it's been Dodger world. So that, if anything, you know, I don't know what kind of fans the Angels have compared to the Dodgers, but if I was an Angel fan, we've been pissed on for a long time, don't you think?
ESPN's Peter Gammons, who was also hanging around Fenway Park Wednesday, agrees with Eckersley that, for the most part, the Angels have been second-class citizens, at least as far as the glitziest Angelinos are concerned.
I think the one thing is I think the Angels look at the Dodgers and see all the Hollywood personalities behind home plate during the games, and they go, because you're not going to see any celebrities at Angels games.
Of course, those celebrities at Dodgers games have places other than the ballpark to go and people other than the players to see. This circumstance and the dependably heavy traffic in and around L.A. explain why fans there have gained a reputation for showing up in the fourth inning and leaving after the seventh. Though he's only been with the Angels for a couple of seasons, Torrey Hunter has become accustomed to that behavior.
Out there, it's a show. You know, it's a big show. And seventh inning, they're trying to get home before traffic. That's the way the life feels out there.
But I hope, for the World Series.
But for the World Series, I promise it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm pretty sure everybody's going to stay, and they're going to hang out after the game. It's going to be awesome. And it's going to be a packed city. Traffic's really going to be bad. So you're not going anywhere, so stay around.
And there you have it. The possibility of an Angels-Dodgers World Series is tantalizing enough to have a veteran like Torrey Hunter disregarding the first commandment of professional athletes: thou shalt not look beyond today's game. And I can't blame him a bit. It seems to me that of the potential ultimate matchups likely to be available a little over a month from now, Anaheim-LA might be as good as most and more fun than many. The WNBA postseason began this week with 8 teams competing to reach the semifinals, which will begin on Wednesday. Joining me now to discuss what's transpired so far in the WNBA playoffs is Clay Callum of Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Always good to be here.
The Detroit Shock swept the Atlanta Dream by virtue of victories on Wednesday and Friday. The Shock are through to the semifinals. Does the team have what it takes to win its fourth WNBA championship in 7 years?
Not without Katie Smith. Beating Atlanta, a team that lost its starting point guard in the last regular season game, wasn't really a surprise. The Shock had been playing very well, but when Katie went down, she's got some serious back issues. That pretty much limits their ability to succeed. They're missing not only Katie Smith, but also Plenette Pearson, two just crucial, crucial players in their title run. And also Cheryl Ford is still battling to recover from an ACL. So they're really not the team they once were.
Atlanta improved from 4-30 in 2008, including 17 straight losses to begin that inaugural season, to 18-16 in this, their second season. Do you think the Dream are happy enough that they just made the playoffs this year?
Oh, absolutely. And losing Shaylee Lenning, their surprise point guard, really was a killer blow. She's not a great WNBA player, but she's the perfect point guard for that team. And to all of a sudden have to adjust to Ivory Latta, who actually was cut by Atlanta earlier in the year before coming back to play about 18 or 19 minutes a game, that was just too much for a new team to overcome.
Bill Laimbeer led the Shock to their three WNBA championships. Then he stepped down as head coach back in June. Laimbeer's former Pistons teammate Rick Mahorn succeeded him. What, if anything, did Mahorn bring to that team that Laimbeer hadn't?
Well, Laimbeer is not the most popular guy in the world, and Mahorn was sort of the nice guy in the good cop, bad cop scenario that they ran. And I think Mahorn just sort of kept it going. Cheryl Reeve is there, so there was enough continuity. And really, it's about talent. Coaching is coaching, but I think any coach will tell you that when you have really good players like Deanna Nolan and Katie Smith, you're really a lot smarter.
You know, this characterization of Rick Mahorn as the good guy is going to be a little tough for anybody who remembers Johnny Most to believe.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, in Boston, it's a little different. But, you know, out here in California, we're a little more laid back. So we don't automatically assume that he's going to beat up the next person he sees.
Especially as a coach. You know, Right. Players are a little more inclined to do that.
But. Right.
Shamiqua Holzclaw has had a terrific 2009 season, just 2 years after retiring from Los Angeles to deal with depression. Did you think that she would bounce back so quickly?
I'm really not surprised. There are a lot of issues involved. She continued to play in Europe. She never stopped playing professional basketball. That was never an issue. She was, obviously, that's how she makes her living. When Mary Nell Meadors took over in Atlanta, there was a sense that Shamiqua might come back to that particular franchise. And she was a good enough player that she could have sort of tell the league, look, I'll come back here, but not there.
The Los Angeles Sparks and Seattle Storm are now knotted at a game apiece in their opening round series. The Sparks' Lisa Leslie will retire at the end of this postseason, so championship would be a nice way for her to go out.
I think so. I think she's not the most popular player in visiting arenas. She's booed almost everywhere she goes. But, of course, her historical significance in women's basketball really is unparalleled. She's a great, great player. She's succeeded really at every level. I would expect that the Sparks will manage to win Game 3 and move on, because without Lauren Jackson and with Sue Bird battling a balky neck, which is an odd injury for a basketball player, I just don't think the Storm have quite enough firepower to hang with the Sparks.
The Indiana Fever beat the Washington Mystics in Thursday's Game 1 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. No surprise there for the team with the WNBA's second-best regular season record, I guess.
No surprise at all, especially when you look back. That makes it, I believe, 11 out of the last 12 that Indiana has beaten Washington. The Mystics have never really been a strong franchise, and Indiana has beaten them like a rented mule, as the saying goes. So,
on the other hand, the Phoenix Mercury, which earned the WNBA's best regular season record, fell to the San Antonio Silver Stars on Thursday night. An upset in the making in terms of the whole series?
It's certainly possible. One of the big things that's happened to San Antonio is the emergence of Edwija Lawson-Wade, who is all of a sudden making three-pointers like she never has before. And Shanna Crossley is finally back from a series of knee injuries. And those two perimeter shooters really changed the game. That means Phoenix can't really play the zone that it really likes to play. And it just means that Cappy Pondexter and Diana Taurasi have to have bigger games than normal. And I still would expect that Phoenix will find a way to win, but it wouldn't be a shocker if Becky Hammon makes a buzzer beater.
Clay, I hate to bring this next question up because it seems to come up every time we have a discussion about the WNBA, but tell me a little bit about progress or lack of same regarding attendance.
Attendance was definitely down this year. The league reported a small increase, I think 91 total people, but those who were actually in the arenas reported a significant decline in almost every city except perhaps Washington. Attendance is a problem, but hey, there's a recession going on, and that's certainly having a major impact in all kinds of discretionary income. So it's not surprising that WNBA's attendance went down. On the other hand, the television ratings went up. So there's a sense that more and more people are caring about the league, but given the economic situation, fewer people actually went to the arenas this year.
Clay Callum covers women's pro hoops for Full Court Press, and he joins us from time to time here on Only a Game for Same. Thank you, Clay.
Oh, thank you, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find. Catch me a catch.
Speed dating has taken on new meaning and greater acceleration. At Alton Towers Amusement Park in Staffordshire, England, the park is offering a speed dating service in which participants are paired up in line for a ride on Rita, Queen of Speed, Spinball Whizzer, or another of the park's attractions. Since some of the rides last as little as 49 seconds and propel visitors along their tracks at up to 62 miles an hour, Alton Towers is advertising the experience as an exceptionally fast, short introduction to the man or woman of your dreams. Morwena Ongove, who is the sales and marketing director at Alton Towers, promises the thrilling ride and the added exhilaration of meeting a potential new partner will ensure the most memorable date ever.
Find me a find, catch me a...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a look back at the 1968 Summer Olympics with Sports Illustrated senior writer Richard Hoffer. But first, one of the most memorable U.S. Open tournaments in recent years saw 20-year-old Juan Martín Del Potro defeat Roger Federer, the owner of more Grand Slam victories than any man. Sure, fans celebrated Monday at Arthur Ashe Stadium, but they really celebrated in the Argentinian farming town where Del Potro was born, raised, and where he trained. Ian Mount has the story.
When Roger Federer's last backhand went long, 20-year-old Argentine tennis star Juan Martín Del Potro fell to the court and covered his tear-filled eyes. But his U.S. Open victory was celebrated most passionately in Del Potro's hometown, the farming hub Tandil. Residents poured into the streets to cheer, drivers leaned in their horns, and some of the 350 Tennis Academy students at Club Independiente, the sports club where Del Potro learned how to play, lifted his childhood coach Marcelo Gomez onto their not-so-broad shoulders and paraded him around the grounds. A small city of some 120,000 people, 230 miles south of Buenos Aires, Tandil was famed, at least until Monday, for its country salamis. Now famed as the birthplace of 6 foot 6 inch Del Potro, whose nickname is the Tower of Tandil. It's a quiet place where most everyone seems to know the tennis player or someone in his family. Tandil is surrounded by hills, silos, cropland, and grazing fields spotted with Argentina's famous beef cattle. Few buildings rise above 5 stories. And good luck finding an open store between 2 and 5 p.m. That's the afternoon siesta. Club Independiente sits several blocks south of the city center, behind a modest warehouse-like entrance pocked with chipped cement. The club has enjoyed improbable success even beyond Del Potro's win. During the last 2 years, 5 of its alumni have made it into the top tier of the ATP rankings.
Pico, Mariano, Del Potro, González.
Pico, Monaco, Mariano Zabaleta, Del Potro, Diego Junquera, and Máximo González were all in the top 100. They were 5 from the same city and the same club among the top 100 in the world. Something that was only matched by Moscow. But Moscow has 7 million inhabitants, and we have 120,000.
That's Marcelo Gomez, the head of Club Independiente's tennis academy and the coach who discovered Del Potro at age 6. Gomez trained at the academy in the 1980s, alongside Tandil's first tennis prodigy, former 13th-ranked Guillermo Pérez Roldán. When Gomez realized he would never make it as a pro, he turned to coaching. His first student, Mariano Zabaleta, won the French Open Juniors title in 1995.
We work against the backboard, which isn't done anymore. We insist on discipline. We have very tough training sessions. The kids understand that tennis is repetitive, that the exercises are boring, and that you have to do them. They take a long time, and you have to hit the ball a lot. And those who understand it, do it.
Indeed, on the courts of Club Independiente, you won't find radar guns, ball machines, or anything resembling the latest technology. Players pick up their own balls, and the youngest students play mini-tennis on a bald lawn. Instead of luxury, there is repetition. Gomez's 350 students practice by banging balls off a backboard or pairing off 4 to a court and drilling shots back and forth. Club Independiente is a microcosm for Argentina, which has turned out an inordinate number of professional athletes by compensating for its relative poverty with sacrifice and repetition.
They don't have very good courts. They don't have very good balls. They just focus on the effort and fight spirit. Tandil is a typical tennis school of the country of Argentina, doing things with great effort and a lot of passion. That's the secret.
Gustavo Lussa, former Argentine Davis Cup team captain.
That's amazing, and what countries more powerful or developed than us cannot understand. They have a lot of resources, economically rich, but they cannot motivate their guys.
For Lussa, what's happened at Club Independiente is the tennis version of a snowball effect. Pérez Roland's success inspired Zabaleta, who inspired Monaco, González, Junqueira, and the young Del Potro. This chain seems to have some new links with Del Potro's win. 15-year-old Ignacio Arfeli, who moved from Buenos Aires to Tandil to train at Club Independiente, says that after watching Del Potro's victory alongside his fellow students at the club, he now believes he has a chance to make the big time.
By winning the U.S. Open, Del Potro inspired us all more. We have more opportunities to make it to the professional level.
Though it's far from being a tennis shrine on the scale of Florida's Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, the success of Club Independiente alumni has led to a kind of international student boom. Almost half of its top 60 players now come from other parts of Argentina, Venezuela, Ecuador, Brazil, and Hungary. They board with local families, and many do their schooling online so they can practice and work out some 6 hours per day. 16-year-old Colombian Julieta Lizarazo started training at Club Independiente 2 years ago.
Creo que lo que más influye es la movilidad, la disciplina.
I think what's most important here is mobility, the discipline, always trying hard, always concentrating. It's the best place in South America.
Uno de los mejores sitios en Sudamérica.
One of the first things one notices about Tandil is the impressive number of residents who bike, run, or otherwise exercise in the middle of a weekday. Several local parks sport open-air erg rowing machines, and Tandil has also turned out its share of top soccer players. Mayor Miguel Lungi plays down anything to do with Tandil's environment or Tandilense DNA. There's a good tennis academy in town, he says. Nothing more.
No hay otra explicación.
There's no other explanation I can give you. Neither the air, nor the hills, nor the food is going to make you a better tennis player.
A ser mejor jugador de tenis, ¿no?
Paula Cardinale, a chef who remembers serving Del Potro café con leche when she worked at the Club Independiente cafeteria several years ago, attributes the town's athletic prowess to the climate.
I think it's the air. The hill air treats us really well. They bring a lot of people here for rehabilitation.
But although she welcomes Tandil's turn in the spotlight, Cardinale wants to make sure no one forgets Tandil's roots.
Now everybody says Tandil is the birthplace of tennis players, but the salamis are really good, you know. You have to try them.
For Only a Game, I'm Ian Mount.
In the first chapter of his new book, Something in the Air, Richard Hoffer writes, "Glory germinates unpredictably." Perhaps no Olympics has offered more varied and unpredictable germinations of glory, among other things, than the 1968 Games, the subject of Something in the Air, which is subtitled American Passion and Defiance in the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. Sports Illustrated senior writer Richard Hoffer joins me now from KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
The athletes aspiring to compete in the 68 Olympics faced all the challenges elite athletes always face, and then some. At what point did it begin to become apparent to at least some of those athletes that they would be expected to think about politics as well as athletic preparation?
I think it became apparent early on to the athletes. After all, this was 1968. Heroes were dying left and right. Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, there was a war going on. This was a very politicized time, as well as the whole youth movement. So these kids were very much caught up in it, and I think it began to occur to them that sports might be a way to leverage their beliefs.
Central to the possibility that at least some of the black athletes from the U.S. would boycott the 68 Games was a coach named Harry Edwards. How did he come to be such an influential figure among young track and field athletes?
Well, it was almost accidental. He happened to be in the right place at the right time. He was sort of at ground zero of this speed city. It was kind of the sprint movement in our country at that time, and he was a young black athlete himself. He had gone through the system and didn't like it much, and he was agitating for something as simple as student housing for black athletes. Black athletes were being brought into these institutions, but they were not really treated as students, and typical of this whole movement was a very inappropriate reaction by old white men, as I call them, but the authority in general, which seemed to accelerate the protest and the radicalism of that time.
Very shortly before the games began, the Mexican authorities surrounded a group of students who were demonstrating against the government. They trapped those students in a plaza and murdered perhaps as many as 300 of them. If the government hadn't successfully covered up those murders, would the 68 Olympics even have occurred?
Well, imagine something similar happening in China before the Beijing Olympics. Of course not. We would have pulled the plug on that. We weren't yet as queasy about sending our kids abroad as we are now. That kind of changed in Munich. But if we had known what was going on in Mexico City, if we had really had an idea, we wouldn't have sent our kids there. I don't believe that.
The most famous gestures connected to the Mexico City Olympics came when Tommy Smith and John Carlos stood on the podium after the 200 meters final and raised their black gloved fists over their heads. If the U.S. Olympic officials had not shortly thereafter removed Smith and Carlos from the team and hustled them out of Mexico, how big a deal would those gestures have been?
If the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, meaning Avery Brundage, hadn't stepped in and called for their ouster, this might have gone away. There were no plans otherwise to build on this event, and it could have just fizzled on its own, I think. But people wanted to do something. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to represent their beliefs, and they chose according to their opportunities.
Fewer people know about the gesture of a Czech gymnast named Vera Kozlovska, but that gesture, her gesture, was in some ways at least as dramatic as what Smith and Carlos did. Tell us that story.
Well, it was a very powerful gesture. She was a gymnast from Czechoslovakia, and she had been involved in the uprisings there among the students, and the Soviets had more or less steamrolled that movement. She refused to acknowledge the Soviet national anthem. It was the most modest gesture. You really had to look for it, but she simply dipped her beehived head. Except for TV and the ability of them to interpret this event, that would have gone unnoticed too, but it was equally as powerful and certainly as dramatic.
Richard, in a short conversation, there's no way to acknowledge all of the exceptional athletic performances at those games, but we have to talk at least a little bit about Dick Fosbury. How did he become such a crowd favorite in Mexico?
Well, he literally turned his sport upside down. I mean, he went over...
Literally is right. He went over the bar backwards.
Exactly. And the fascination for me is that he did it on his own. Sports is one of those things that just proceed along very rigorous doctrines. I mean, you do a certain thing and you do it a certain way and that's it. And he just looked at this high jump and it wasn't working for him. And so he developed all on his own this upside down backwards flop, the Fosbury flop. He was as much a revolutionary as Tommy Smith or John Carlos as far as that goes. I mean, he defied a kind of authority and did things on his own just as everybody was doing in 1968. And of course, he won the gold medal.
One of the guys that Fosbury had to beat in the high jump was a Russian, and he was supposed to be the enemy not only as an athlete but as the representative of a competing ideology. How seriously did Dick Fosbury take that circumstance?
You know, he didn't compete against countries. He didn't even compete against heights. He just competed against performances, you know, when it came time to perform. So when he had a chance to chat with this Russian, he didn't see him as an enemy at all. I mean, the athletes had been advised, you know, don't talk to these guys. You know, they're out to dominate our world. But he didn't see it that way. And for Fosbury, that was his Olympic moment. I mean, the idea that, you know, they were athletes first and citizens of the world more than anything else.
I'm speaking with Richard Hoffer, the author of Something in the Air. You're listening to Only a Game. Another somewhat unlikely connection between athletes found the members of the Harvard University crew becoming great friends with the Tiger Bells of Tennessee State University. How did that happen?
Well, this Harvard crew is one of my favorite parts of the story because they kept showing up at every critical juncture in the Olympics, whether it was before, during, or after. And especially this 110-pound coxswain, Paul Hoffman, he was like Zelig in these Olympics. He was everywhere. And they befriended the Tiger Bells, this all-black women's track team, virtually the Olympic team. They were the powerhouse of their day. They ran into them at a pre-Olympic meet, invited them to a dance, which had the eyes of the Olympic Committee popping out of their head. But Harvard crew was a thorn in the Olympic Committee's side because they were befriending all these agitators. I mean, they were trying to support Harry Edwards. They were sending letters out. They were helping guys write letters and just causing all kinds of commotion. Well, the Olympic Committee zeroed in on them. I mean, they actually tried at one point to disqualify the same Paul Hoffman. And when that didn't work out, they more or less rooted for their failure, which happened. And at the end, the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee wrote this letter to the coach, more like a I told you so, and just exulting in their failure. It was horrible.
It's great to talk about some of the specific moments and some of the specific performances in these games, but I'm curious also about the extent to which the 68 games changed the relationship between athletes in the U.S. and USOC officials responsible for organizing this country's Olympic efforts.
Well, I think for the first time, athletes were starting to realize they were stakeholders in this process. Before that, they have been pretty much obliging participants. They went along with a program. Nobody goes along with a program like athletes. They're groomed to do what they're told. But whether it was the shoe companies providing money all of a sudden, whether it was new outlets of media that were providing more fame and celebrity, I think they were beginning to realize that they had more control than they ever had before. And I think now we realize that the athletes are the stars of these things.
Richard Hoffer is the author of Something in the Air, American Passion and Defiance in the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. The book is published by Free Press, and Richard Hoffer joined me from KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Is cheerleading a sport? People have made convincing cases for both sides of that argument. Is a cheerleader any match for a 10-foot-long, 353-pound alligator? That question was settled this week when Cammie Collin, a 16-year-old cheerleader at White Knoll High School in Pelion, South Carolina, nailed said alligator from a boat in a swamp near Santee with a crossbow. Cammie and four of her friends lured the creature toward the boat. Cammie let fly, and then they taped the gator's mouth shut and hauled it to the shore. Said Cammie, "I was very shocked when it got to the boat that it was that size." If the alligator had been able to speak, it probably would have said the same thing about Cammie. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, you'll laugh, you'll cry, and if you cry well enough, perhaps you'll win. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Baseball's divisional races are lacking in much of the drama that we've come to expect at this time of year, but the Rockies look like they just might manage an unexpected wild card berth. Do you like Colorado to pull it off?
Well, I like Colorado's advantage in playing in Colorado, basically. They're a very hard team to figure on the road. But they have managed to hold off San Francisco a little bit, and I think they may well make it back to the playoffs.
Times, of course, are tense in baseball as the days dwindle down. Yankees catcher Jorge Posada and Toronto pitcher Jesse Carlson were suspended this week following a brawl. I don't suppose that'll derail the Yankees.
No, I don't think so. They were fined for, quote, aggressive and inappropriate actions.
Mm.
Posada bumped Carlson after he scored a run. Everybody ran out of the dugouts, the benches and the dugouts and the bullpens emptied. There was the general milling around and falling on each other. But I guess they're trying to, the whole culture of when you get hit by a pitch, when you do this, when you do that in baseball is so ephemeral that it's a wonder they don't have five or six of these episodes a week.
We all know that the Yankees like to throw their money around, Charlie, but is paying a $500,000 signing bonus to a 44th round draft pick taking things just a little too far?
Well, hey, listen, good for Evan DeLuca and whoever's doing his negotiating for him. He had a terrific agent. He was the 1,335th pick in the Major League Draft. He signed on Monday night. He will go off to the minors now, $500,000 richer. This is a great country. That's I keep great. Telling you
Absolutely.
This, Phil.
This means that somebody in the Yankees organization woke up. Hey, what? Oh, yeah. DeLuca, give him $500,000.
Yeah, that's right. They found it. They were going through the sofas in the Steinbrenner office, and they found $500,000, and they didn't want to declare it, so they gave it to this kid.
These days, NFL coaches are not generally known for their one-liners or their sparkling personalities, but perhaps we have an exception in New York.
Yeah, we got Rex Ryan. There's been a lot of real childish nonsense up in Boston on the upcoming game against the Jets. Ryan, of course, famously said he didn't come to New York to kiss Bill Belichick's rings. This week, he put out a voicemail to his season ticket holders, which I think probably has more to do with the fact that the Jets can't sell personal seat licenses in the new stadium. But in any event, saying, come on out and make a lot of noise. It was really high school. People up here, you know, who are caught in the great fog that Bill Belichick spreads all over everything, went tut, 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 tut. I'm glad to have him in the NFL, to be perfectly honest with you.
All right, here's a question for you, Charlie. When does a player's request to be paid result in a $25,000 fine? And maybe Dante Robinson can tell you.
When he writes it on his shoes, Bill.
Has to be the NFL.
The cornerback, the Houston Texans, wrote down, pay me, Rick, on his shoes. He wants a long-term deal that the Texans are reluctant to give him. The NFL fined him $25,000, not for presenting his personal economy that way, Bill, but for, of course, defacing the uniform.
On Monday, Matt Burke of the Baltimore Ravens, Lofa Tatupu of the Seattle Seahawks, and Sean Morey of the Arizona Cardinals became the first active NFL players to agree to donate their brains to study the long-term effects of multiple concussions. Does this suggest to you that players are taking the risk of brain injury more seriously?
Yeah, I'd like to believe that you're bringing through the system now a younger generation of players who've been raised within a football context that takes the concussion problem very seriously. And this is good for them, particularly Sean Morey, who's a terrific guy. He played in New England for a while. This is a very encouraging sign.
On Wednesday, Miles Brand, perhaps best known as the guy who fired former Indiana basketball coach Bob Knight, died of pancreatic cancer. For the past 6.5 years, Brand has been president of the NCAA, where one of his major concerns was academic accountability. Can we credit Mr. Brand with some success in that regard?
Who knows? I mean, the entire system of having large-scale sports entertainment grafted onto universities is untenable and unsustainable. Perhaps he moved things along a little bit. There's only so much you can do with that, though, unfortunately.
Labor talks between the NBA and the league's officials are at a stalemate, and union lead negotiator Lamel McMorris says a lockout is, quote, imminent and unavoidable. So should we get ready for the NBA to go to playground rules, call your own fouls, come the first exhibition game on October the 1st?
You know what? I'd much prefer that to bringing in replacement officials, which is what they're going to do. I was in the middle, of course, of the very famous have another donut, you fat pig, outburst with Jim Schoenfeld in the Stanley Cup playoffs 20 years ago, where the referees went on strike because the NHL hadn't defended Don Koharski against the charges that he was a fat pig who should have another donut. And they brought in a couple of guys who, and I'm not making this up,
they literally
ran a skating rink, and it was an appalling example. I'd rather have the players call their own. I think it'd be fun. Play the first, 3 weeks of the season outdoors, for that matter.
Okay, Mr. Motorsports, perhaps you can help me to understand why, number one, a driver for Renault Formula One was ordered to crash his car into the wall last September in Singapore, and number two, why said driver went ahead and did it?
All right, answer the second question first. The man is coachable. We admit this, don't we? Wow.
I've heard of taking one for the team.
I mean,
but this is ridiculous.
Renault, which is certainly going to have to answer to a lot of people for this, had a driver named Nelson Piquet Jr., and he was ordered to spin his car into a concrete wall so his teammate, Fernando Alonso, could win the race. Two people have already been fired over this. This is insane. Exactly how different from World Wrestling Entertainment is this, except for the fact they're going 200 miles an hour and running automobiles into walls.
What could possibly go wrong?
Don't worry, Coach. What could possibly go wrong with this?
And finally, Charlie, one might suppose that in the LFL, the Lingerie Football League,
it
would be difficult to bring a runner down by grabbing her uniform, but apparently it happens.
Apparently one of the members of the Miami Caliente, and I am just embarrassed to be reading this, was playing a road game against the Chicago Bliss, and one of the Calientes went for the tackle and fastened on the bottom of a bikini, and we're just not going to go any further with this, Bill, because I'd rather talk about guys being asked to spin their automobiles into walls.
Well, maybe we should just go straight to the music. As I say, Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Muy caliente, Bill.
Commentator Alyssa Eli recently attempted to navigate the generation gap via parasail and shares what she saw on the way up.
Some adults do not appreciate heights. Some of us like to pull the window shades down before our plane takes off and pretend to read the pocket magazine when we're actually overcome with elevation anxiety. But here we were, strapping up for an ascent almost a quarter of a mile into naked sky. We were parasailing. It wasn't my idea. I was doing it for my child. The motorboat captain spoke from a script while he handed out life preservers. "Ladies," he said to my daughter and me, "there are two situations I'm required to warn you about. First, the boat may break down. In this case, we are equipped to immediately call for help. Secondly, the line connecting the sail to the boat may become severed. In that case, the parasail will function as your parachute. You will float safely and gently down to the water, where I will immediately rescue you." It was the deliberate adverbs that arrested my attention. I saw myself floating safely and gently down to sea, like Mary Poppins under her umbrella. Then I realized the image was not honest. It was too lulling, too serene. He was describing a crash landing. "When's the last time this happened?" I asked. The child beside me, securely roped in, listened. "Actually," the captain said reluctantly, "I picked someone out of the water last week." The eyes of my girl lit up. "So cool," she said. The boat sped up and we levitated off the back ramp and into sky. Side by side, we gripped our harness straps. I knew, even before we hit parasailing altitude, that she was planning our emergency landing. Each of us was filled with the opposite hope. And this is only the smallest difference between us. She is rising into sky and in her life beyond that. I dread the very things she hopes for. Yet I know that next time she asks for my company, to fly together and maybe to fall, I will pull the window shade all the way up just to be near her. God help the loving middle-aged.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living near Boston. The image of a town crier evokes thoughts ranging from the Revolutionary War to cultural critic Grail Marcus's relatively modern notion of the old weird America. But the ancient art is alive and well, as Avishai Artsy reports from the first annual town crier competition held last month in the small town of Hillsborough, New Hampshire.
"Kind hearts, dear, gentle souls, welcome to this splendid soiree. We make history today in New Hampshire!"
No one makes an entrance like a man in colonial costume clanging a big brass bell. It's a rainy Saturday afternoon, and a crowd of about 100 sit on folding chairs under a white tent facing a stage.
"My name is Redmond O'Colonies, American champion crier and host for the competition."
A few yards behind Redmond are the six competitors, clutching gold scrolls and shifting nervously in their puffy shirts, breeches, and tricorn hats. It's all part of Hillsborough, New Hampshire's first annual Living History event.
"Our roots are traced back to the ancient Greek runners who took messages from one community to another. The first mention of a town crier is in the Doomsday Book, circa 1075 or 76, and we never went away despite these upstart new medias such as print, radio, television, and internet."
Redmond O'Colonies might be town crying's greatest ambassador, Born Redmond O'Connell, he was an environmental activist when, in 1991, he played a town crier for a rally in Martinez, California. That's when he found his calling, so to speak. He's since been named American Champion Crier twice and was a founder and president of the American Guild of Town Criers. He's traveled the world, popped up at wedding proposals, greeted cruise ships, and has hung out with celebrities like Robin Williams and Dame Edna.
The Good Town Crier is able to get the word across in as efficient a way as possible, needs presence, be able to command attention in this world of ever-decreasing attention spans.
To the picturesque town of Hillsborough in the beautiful state of New Hampshire.
Prior to today's competition, contestants drew names from a hat. The first up is Richard McNamara, a nutrition counselor from Hillsborough. This is McNamara's first time playing a town crier, and he's clearly enjoying the role.
I was up in the center of town, what they call the Village of Hillsborough Center today, and they asked me to come up, and I just kind of walked around with the bell and kind of announced some of the events that were going to take place just, you know, off the top of my head. And the kids really perk up, and they listen, they look at you. And, of course, I'm dressed in a little bit of a costume here, so I think children like that, and I suppose adults like it as well. But you can really see the children, they really become animated when they see someone in the persona of a town crier.
Other competitors have years of experience. Michael Plosky is a small-town post office employee. He's played a town crier for 6 years at the Newmarket Heritage Festival.
One of my favorite memories from town crying in Newmarket was one year the people that made the Segway showed up, and they have pictures of me in the town crier outfit with the bell riding the Segway.
The youngest contestant is 10-year-old Matthew Otten. He adapted his speech from a fourth-grade paper on Franklin Pierce, the only U.S. president to come from New Hampshire.
During his presidential campaign, one of his slogans was, "First you were Polked, now you are Pierced." If I was old enough to run for president myself, I might take after this fellow Hillsborough citizen, Pierce, and my slogan would be, "All the other candidates' choices may be rotten, but not me. I'm Matthew Otten, not to be forgotten."
A panel of judges scores the contestants on accuracy, creativity, sustained volume, clarity, bearing, and elegance. The first round is too close to call, so Redmond declares a second round. He's written topics on scraps of paper and invites each contestant to pull one from his hat.
And talk for as close to 1 minute on the subject that's on the paper.
Look at that. Look at their faces.
Always expect the unexpected.
With looks of anguish, the contestants take their turns, speaking on esoteric topics including but not limited to clowns, hot dogs, weeds, and junk.
This is going surprisingly well. I mean, this is not easy to extemporize. Michael, 1 minute, please, on gloves.
Gloves. We all love gloves. They keep our hands warm in the wintertime.
It's a little painful for everyone involved, but for Redmond, who leads workshops on public speaking, these moments can be transformative.
What do we fear most? We fear speaking. And why do we fear that? Well, what is it? We fear being judged by others. And so with that in mind, once I had intellectualized that, I said, I can choose to be above and beyond their judgment.
The competition wraps up, and Hillsborough resident Michael Bradley wins first place for his cry on the creation of a U.S. Department of Peace and his improvised speech on flies. Redmond said he was impressed with the results, though a little dismayed at the turnout.
At some stage we had 12 potential criers signed up, and on the day we only had 6. So I think the weather, and maybe possibly some nerves, but had they come down and met with me, I would have been there to encourage and to give them advice, to tell them, go out there and give it your best shot.
Hillsborough plans to hold its Living History event again next year, and perhaps if they can effectively get the word out, there will be the second annual Town Crier competition. For Only a Game, I'm Avishai Artsy.
Oh, yay! Oh, yay! Oh, yay!
sit ye up and list ye well. General Stark boils the British.
I'm the town crier, and everybody knows I'm a little down with a lifetime to go. Maybe you don't believe my heart is in the right place. Why don't you take a good look at my face?
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had translation help from Jill Ryan, Monica Brady-Meyerhoff, and Peter No Parking Zone Lydotes. Special thanks to Jim Rondo at KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. Our senior producer is Gary Wallace. If you'd like to view Abishai Artsy's Town Crier photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories, past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Tandil resident Manuza Loganegro, who theorizes that Tandil turns out so many successful tennis players because its residents are well-fed.
It could be because here we eat a lot of meat and pasta.
Carne y pastas.
That can't be it. I ate the meat, I ate the pasta, nothing. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
I'm the town crier, and everybody knows I'm a little down with a lifetime to go. Maybe you don't believe my heart is in the right place.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.